You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. It is day one of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Big convention for Wisconsin Republicans. There are seven of them slated to speak at the convention. Sean Johnson is in Cleveland for the convention. He joins us now to talk about it. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for WPR News. Sean, welcome from Cleveland.
Hey, Rob.
Well, you were at the Wisconsin Delegates Breakfast this morning. What was that event like?
Yeah, I'll tell you what they let us see, which was a very limited portion of it, was Paul Ryan's address to the delegation. And, you know, in a week that's really supposed to be about unifying the party, getting behind the party nominee, it's pretty notable that Paul Ryan did not mention, in that speech anyway, didn't mention Donald Trump by name. So, you know, he did talk about a number of the House GOP platforms, but, you know, I think as you see what's kind of unfolding at the convention this afternoon, which is a little bit of chaos, I think a lot of the comments this morning that the party's all unified and we're all headed the same direction now, maybe a bit premature.
And we'll get into more of what Speaker Ryan had to say this morning, Sean. But first, can you set the scene? Where does a state capitol reporter from Wisconsin set up to do these interviews from the convention center there?
Oh, right now I'm in a big cavernous convention center where reporters from all over the place have workstations. So I wouldn't call this right here exactly a front row seat to what's happening in the, you know, the rules fight right now. But what's happening in the arena where the Cleveland Cavaliers play their basketball games is that they just had a pretty raucous shouting fight between anti-Trump activists who wanted to force a vote on the floor to unbind delegates that would give them a chance to potentially vote for somebody other than Trump in the nomination process. And it failed, and just the procedural way that it failed was that the chair essentially didn't recognize them, walked off the stage, came back on the stage, and then they just did a voice vote. And so one side yelled, you know, "I" as loudly as possible. The other side screams "no." And the chair, who's working for the RNC, says, "Okay, the ayes have it. Let's move on." And that's essentially where the anti-Trump forces were left.
So not a perfect harmony there, you were saying.
No, definitely not this afternoon. So, you know, this is the first day of the convention, and, you know, rules fights can be pretty raucous. But anyone thinking that, okay, we've accepted that he's the nominee now and everything's going to be fine, these party activists didn't think so. And it wasn't just people off the street. I mean, there were U.S. senators there who were making a big show of it.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of what Speaker Ryan had to say. You've got some audio from that. Can you set that up for us?
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, Speaker Ryan was really talking about the House Republican caucus, which he now leads and has for a little while now. So Speaker Ryan's basic point was that, in his words, they've gotten really good at being an opposition party, but they don't, again, in his words, didn't know how to be a proposition party. They didn't know how to set the agenda and tell people there's another way. And so his goal as leader is just sort of lay out that alternative path for Republicans. Here's a little bit of what the speaker had to say to Wisconsin delegates this morning.
So many people turn on the TV and they just see a food fight. So many people turn on the TV and they just see people yelling at each other. They see all this acrimony, all this anxiety. What we are trying to do is say there's a better way. All of these problems in America, they're fixable problems.
Was he describing Congress there or the rules fight at the convention that was coming, I guess, after he spoke at breakfast?
Yeah, he was not that prescient. He was describing Congress there. And, you know, it's a sentiment you've heard from Ryan a lot recently as he's tried to kind of get people to pay attention to him and his members as one of the prominent faces of the GOP when really... there's been a lot more and continues to be a lot more focus on Donald Trump and who occasionally says stuff that's not in line with what Republicans are used to or what they like.
And I understand Speaker Ryan tried to get some focus on particular policies, including the IRS and the tax code.
Yeah, so he laid out his priorities, and a few of them had to do with what he views as federal government overreach. Had some choice words for the Internal Revenue Service and about cleaning up the tax code.
The Internal Revenue Service is one of the most intrusive bureaucracies, one of the most arrogant and paternalistic bureaucracies I've ever experienced and ever dealt with. I used to be the person overseeing it as the Ways and Means Chairman. One of the reasons is because of the tax code that they enforce. This tax code is riddled so full of loopholes that it gives so much discretion and so much power to these unelected bureaucracies. We have got to clean up our tax code.
Talking to WPR reporter Sean Johnson, reporting from the Republican National Convention. Just heard the voice of Speaker Paul Ryan talking this morning at a Wisconsin delegate breakfast. Wisconsin, a whole lot of Wisconsin at this thing. Sean, can you run through some of the prominent Wisconsin politicians and others talking today, or throughout the week, I should say?
There is, especially for a state that was the last state that Donald Trump lost in his march to the nomination. And a state where a lot of Wisconsin Republicans are still uneasy about him. There are now 7 Republicans who are slated to speak in prime time at this convention this week. You've got one is kind of a given, Republican National Convention Committee Chair Reince Priebus, former chair of the state committee. You have Paul Ryan, who has now been formally elected the chairman of this convention. You have Governor Scott Walker, who was until recently somewhat critical of Donald Trump. Some Republicans were holding out hope, however thin, that he might ride in and potentially be nominated in an open convention. That's not going to happen. He's speaking at the convention for Donald Trump. You've also got Congressman Sean Duffy, whose district, the 7th district in northern Wisconsin, Donald Trump won, and Sheriff David Clark of Milwaukee, who is very outspoken advocate for gun rights, kind of a darling of the National Rifle Association, and an outspoken critic of the Black Lives Matter movement. He's going to speak tonight. That's going to, you have to kind of frame the situation in which we're going to hear his remarks. He pulls no punches, and he's speaking on a national stage here at a time when we've had videos of police violence, police being shot, and so I think his remarks will be closely watched.
And also U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and then Rachel, I understand Campos Duffy, Sean Duffy's wife, will be speaking. Is there something to this? You know, this Wisconsin was the last barricades of the Stop Trump movement. So is there some thought among Republicans if Wisconsin Republicans can come in, make nice, get behind the Donald Trump campaign, that's going to help heal any rifts?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the thinking is exactly. I'm sure having the chairman of the Republican National Convention give these people a call and say, hey, we're looking for speakers, probably helps. A couple of them would naturally be there anyway. Ron Johnson's a pretty interesting case because, you know, he's a vulnerable Republican incumbent senator. A lot of vulnerable incumbents might want to stay away from a convention like this and not wholeheartedly endorse Donald Trump. Ron Johnson's campaign had said that he would not be at the convention. So this is definitely a change from that, and a change in a big way, because not only is he going to be there, he's going to speak there.
Can you talk a little bit, Sean, as we wrap up, about the police and the protest scene you've seen so far? Obviously, a lot of eyes on that from around the country.
Yeah, I mean, the police presence is probably, like nothing I've seen before in terms of just the way that the city and the downtown, really specifically the downtown, is barricaded. The center where I'm at right now is surrounded by not only these concrete barriers, but these, these tall steel cages, basically, and there are police all over the place. And, police in armor watched a protest go through downtown last night, and the police riding alongside on bicycles in really tight formations were wearing this kind of breathable armor and helmets that looked like kind of a cross between you know, BMX gear and riot gear. So definitely an unusual setting outside of these events in Cleveland right now.
Sean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joins us to talk about the first day of the Republican National Convention and the role Wisconsin's playing there. He's going to be with us live every day this week to fill us in on the latest from the Republican National Convention. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at kids and concussions and a recent study showing a big increase in concussion diagnoses for 10 to 19-year-olds. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Carving fruit and vegetables into flowers and other works of art has a long history in Thailand. I first saw Monsiri Baird's beautiful fruit and vegetable carvings at a festival in Madison. She came into our studio to carve a watermelon into a flower and to share how she learned her craft.
When you begin to carve, you have to begin with the thing that's delicate first, because your hand's going to ruin it.
What are you making?
I'm making the kind of cactus that's very simple designed, but it looks nice.
Do you always know going into it what you're going to make?
Yes, I have to decide first. It's a Thai tradition. 700 years ago, one servant, her name was Nang Nupamat. She made her basket with the fruit on vegetable carvings. She did that and was very impressed to the king. So he wrote about special, unique, beautiful carved fruit and vegetables. We even learned that poem that he wrote at school. I learned when I'm in about grade 6. Just like a class that the teacher introduced to us. Every kid have to learn that. Boys too, they divide into groups and then help each other to carve basic things like cucumber, watermelon, because it has the three color in one fruit. And when you carve it, you can see the white and you can see the red inside, and your flowers look good. When I grow up, I kind of forget about it. And then at university in Thailand, and I thought I should do something that I like. So I think of this. And then I begin to do it. And I just keep practice and practice. Any time that I have free time. So I love it. I just want to expand this skill to some other people. Because I'm thinking, oh, if I am not alive, so it's going to die with me. So I just expand to some other people. To my friends, to my community. Yeah. You know, in Thai, they say, when you're eating, your tongue not only tests, but your eyes have to test too.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
From fruit and vegetable carving, we now turn to an art form often on full display in our state's Northwoods region, chainsaw carving. Joining us now to talk more about this delicate skill is Diana Peterson, Executive Director of the Paul Bunyan Logging Camp Museum in Eau Claire. Starting August 4th, they'll be hosting the U.S. Open Chainsaw Sculpture Championship. Diana, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Nice to talk to you.
Well, can you sort of paint us or sculpt us a picture? How does chainsaw carving work?
Well, it is pretty much what it sounds like. It is primarily using chainsaws. They do have a few security guard bars and things they can use for details, but they really use good old-fashioned chainsaws to create these amazing works of art.
So it's a person, it's a chainsaw, and just a big log that they start with, right?
They start off with about an 8-foot log and a chainsaw, and that is about it. And then they end up with this beautifully detailed, everything from wizards to a pride of lions, wolves, fish, you name it.
Can you give us a little history of chainsaw carving? Where did this come from?
Yeah, it really started back in the late 40s and early 50s. A couple guys named Ken Kaiser and Ray Murphy were really the starters of the chainsaw art. And they are the kind of went on to form a group of people who studied with them, and they started filling their trunks with chainsaw art, going around selling them at fairs and things. And then in the 80s, it just really exploded in the U.S., turning into a different kind of art form, almost a performance art, but yet these beautiful masterpieces, true art. And then in the 90s, it really spread internationally, and now you have big competitions in Japan and Germany and quite a community of international artists who work together, learn together, compete with each other, and travel really the world.
And is Wisconsin a big hub for chainsaw carving?
Well, it is as far as fairs and things, but I'm really happy to say that our event has really grown. And what we've been told is there's a competition in Shetland in British Columbia. There's one in Reedsport in Oregon, and that the U.S. Open is the third in Eau Claire, the biggest chainsaw carving competition in the U.S.
And how did it come to be that this competition, this championship, was in Eau Claire?
Well, we were looking for kind of a special niche event for us to hold at the museum to earn some money, and we got involved with a guy named Jamie Dorn, who is a world carver, carves in ice, carves in wood, he carves in Germany and California, lives in Green Bay, and the partnership kind of grew from there, and so this is our sixth year of hosting the U.S. Open.
Talking to Diana Peterson, Executive Director of the Paul Bunyan Logging Camp Museum in Eau Claire, talking about the art of chainsaw carving, of sculpting with chainsaws. Big competition coming up early next month there. Diana, tell us about the championship. What happens? What is the event like?
It's an invitational. So for the competition carvers, they have to be invited based on competitions they've won in Japan and Germany, around the U.S., and we bring in 10 of the top world carvers. We have people coming from Italy, Great Britain, Japan, Brazil, and we have two women carvers. The competition carvers, they will carve one piece from Thursday through Sunday. And then Sunday we have an award ceremony and auction off the pieces. Then we have guest carvers who are carving every day, and we auction off smaller pieces. We have lots of kids events, family entertainment, concessions also going on the whole time.
And is there a spectator element? Can we watch the guest carvers or even the championship carvers at work?
It is. Yeah, you can get really up close and personal. We try to keep things very reasonable. It's $5 a day or $10 for the event, and kids through 17 are free. So people can come and go the entire 4 days. You can pop in 3, 4, 5 times and just see how things are progressing. And Friday night, there's also a social hour where you can meet and greet the carvers, get to know them a little better and talk to them about their work. So you really can watch it go from this basic log to this masterpiece in 4 days.
What is it like watching those works develop over time? Because you probably get to check in and out on all of them as they progress.
Yeah, it's amazing that you start Thursday morning and you see these 10 logs just sitting there. And by the end of the day, they're already kind of starting to be formed. And I would say by Saturday morning, Saturday at noon, they have probably 80% of the actual carving done. And then they start with the details and just really bring them to life.
I don't know if you know their artistic process. Do they come in thinking, this time I'm going to carve the Pride of Lions or whatever? Or do they come in and look at the wood they have and let that speak to them and go from there?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Some people will come in and they say that they've already sketched it out. They know that they want to do this particular piece. One of our Japanese carvers came in 1 year and he really wanted to do monkeys and parrots, and he knew that. And yeah, other people just kind of look at the shape of the wood, think about it a little bit, and sometimes they change. We had a carver from Germany 1 year, and she started doing one piece, got halfway through it, decided it really wasn't working, and totally changed it into a bench.
Wow.
In the middle of her sculpture.
Now, the most complicated thing I've ever carved from a log with a chainsaw is a smaller log. Have you ever tried your hand at this, Diana?
No. And I'm thinking nobody around the museum really wants to see that either. So we'll keep our insurance rates lower that way.
Yeah, definitely. So how do people get started on this? How do people do this for the first time?
Well, you know, it's really funny, whether it's a beginner, a hobbyist, or some of these true artists that spend their whole time carving, I have never heard anyone not tell me the same story, and it's always that they were somewhere at a fair, at an event, they saw someone carving, it just really captivated them, spoke to them, and then they found a mentor and began the carving process. And I honestly have never heard another story about that.
How does judging work on the big competition?
We bring in professional judges, and there's a sheet where they give points for a lot of different. We actually have that available, and we're going to have that out on our website so people can see it. But part of it's intricacy, part of it is theme, part of it is just they can look at carvings and just see how intricate it was, how hard it was, what did they use. They just have a lot of criteria that they use, and then the person with the most points comes in first.
As we wrap up, Diana, what have been a couple of your favorites from years past?
We had a Pride of Lions that is my all-time favorite. It was a horizontal piece that was a mother and father lion with the little cubs kind of laying all over them, and they had the most beautiful green eyes, and you could see every claw and every piece of fur was carved very delicately.
Amazing. Well, Diana, thank you so much. Good luck to all the contestants this year.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We've been talking to Diana Peterson. She's executive director of the Paul Bunyan Logging Camp Museum in Eau Claire. You can catch the U.S. Open Chainsaw Sculpture Championship in Eau Claire from August 4th through the 7th. Coming up, a new study says there's been a big increase in concussion diagnoses for kids and teenagers. We'll find out why and get some advice for parents, coaches, and athletes after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, it's day one of the Republican National Convention. Starting tonight at 7, join NPR coverage of the big event in Cleveland. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, the number of kids and teens getting a concussion diagnosis more than doubled between 2007 and 2014. That's according to a study presented at a conference earlier this month, drawing from insurance claim data. Scary news? Maybe. Or maybe it's good news. One possible explanation for the rise in these concussion numbers is that in youth sports, parents, kids, and coaches are taking concussions more seriously and seeking medical attention instead of shaking off a potential head injury. We'll turn now to two Wisconsin experts on youth, sports, and concussions. Dr. Allison Brooks is with us. She's an associate professor of orthopedics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Brooks, thanks for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
And Dr. Kevin Walter is with us. He's director of the Pediatric and Adolescent Sports Medicine Program at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Dr. Walter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Dr. Brooks, first of all, when you see numbers like this, apparently the number of concussion diagnoses going up among kids, do you think we're having more concussions or just paying more attention to them?
I really think that a large proportion of it is explained by the state concussion laws that every state in the union has now and mandatory education, which I think hopefully is resulting in better recognition and reporting. So I think that we haven't had a good handle of what is the true incidence of concussion, and obviously as more people report the injury, I view that as overwhelmingly a positive thing.
And both of you work on sports issues. You've done a lot of work on panels and working with teams. Dr. Walter, do you see a culture change happening, not just in law, but on the sidelines where people are taking these things more seriously?
Slowly but surely we do. I think we're seeing athletes more likely to report their injury. And I'm actually getting stories of teammates who are reporting their own teammates because they're acting differently when they are out on the field or they return to the huddle. These are things that I would venture to say 5 to 7 years ago were kind of unheard of and rare, and it's becoming more frequent. But it still needs to get better. We're not at 100% reporting, like Dr. Brooks said. We need more reporting to be able to get a handle on this, and this is an injury where bad outcomes are truly preventable by reporting. So 90% is not good enough.
Yeah, let's talk about those outcomes and what's at stake, Dr. Brooks. What happens long-term if we have concussions and we ignore them and maybe put kids back out onto the field who are suffering from a concussion?
Well, obviously, that's what's really on everyone's mind right now. And obviously, there is some concerning or scary information, you know, that's coming, you know, from a sport like football at the professional levels. But I think people really need to be cautious in interpreting that data, because how much it applies to the high school population or even the collegiate population, I think we really don't understand at this point, you know, who is really going to go on and have a long-term adverse outcome from playing a collision or contact sport. That being said, you know, athletes, I think we do have some pretty good evidence that athletes who sustain an injury, don't report it, continue to play with symptoms for a period of time, end up really doing worse, at least in the short term. In my experience, those athletes, by the time they do come forward for medical care, you know, are much more symptomatic or really having trouble academically, take much longer to get better. And athletes who maybe say that they're recovered from a concussion and go back to play too soon are a much higher risk of getting a second injury in that same season. And I think that second injury, in my experience, tends to also be much worse and take them much longer to recover from. So I think there are some really important messages that we can give athletes and their coaches and their parents about the importance of reporting an injury and your symptoms immediately rather than continuing to play and participate for a period of time, because there are negative consequences for doing so.
Dr. Walter, I remember, you know, back in the day, not that long ago, if you were watching especially a pro football game, they'd sort of laugh the announcers about somebody getting their bell rung. I imagine that has happened at different levels of sports, different sports. What still needs to happen to change the mentality for coaches who want to keep players in the game, for the players themselves who don't want to take themselves out of the game, they want to be out there and playing? What still needs to happen to get that reporting higher and to get us taken more care after that first injury?
I still think it's just continued awareness and education. I mean, the more we can push that education of what a concussion is, what it feels like, reporting it, and how and why we treat it, hopefully the better people understand the injury and recognize, I agree with Dr. Brooks, with delayed reporting, especially with kids, they take longer to get it back out on the field. And so they don't want to report because they're afraid that they're not going to be able to play, so they don't report it. And then in the end, that ends up costing them more time away from the field when they don't recover. Whereas if they would have reported right away, started resting and appropriate treatment, usually they get better faster and they're back out there. So I think that education and awareness is key. And really beyond that, you know, it's you can't really legislate integrity, and you just have to hope that people do the right thing and report these injuries and keep these kids off when they're symptomatic.
Talking to two experts on concussions and youth sports, Dr. Kevin Walter from Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, Dr. Allison Brooks from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, thoughts, and questions. Again, 800-642-1234. Dr. Walter, I've thought as a parent, my kids play soccer, and I've had those moments like, oh, you hear the bad stuff about concussions. Should they stop playing? Lots of parents asking these questions. What's your message to parents in that boat? Should they still play sports, their kids, even with this risk of concussion?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I am a firm believer in youth sports and athletics. You know, your other options, let's be honest these days, with the childhood obesity epidemic and everyone, you know, complaining, all my kids do are sit on their phone and play games or, you know, hook up to Xbox and start gaming. So sports is a great way to get them out, keep them healthy, get them active. And it also teaches them how to be a teammate, how to be a person, how to win, how to lose, those life lessons. And I think injuries happen, and they can happen. I could slip on the ice when I'm shoveling my sidewalk and get hurt. Obviously, they're more common in sport, so injuries are going to happen, but that's another kind of life lesson. How do you deal with that injury, get through, and really getting through an injury and coming back and playing, the sense of pride that a lot of these young athletes have is quite amazing. So I'm all for sports. I think they can be played relatively safely, and I think they help much, 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 much more than they would potentially cause any harm.
And Dr. Brooks, I know you played collegiate soccer. You work with some of the teams at UW-Madison. What do you think about age-appropriate risk? You know, in soccer, there's talk about when headers should start, things like that. Can we scale sports so they're age-appropriate as athletes develop?
I think, unfortunately, that's still a big unknown. You know, there's a lot of fear and, frankly, litigation driving a lot of, decisions about making changes to youth sports or even collegiate sports. On the other hand, there's always ways that we can make youth sports safer. And I think, actually, USA Hockey is a great example of this idea about how you develop skills in a sport. And they've been willing to, for example, delay the age at which body checking is introduced because of the risk of injury and specifically concussion associated with, you know, at whatever age you introduce body checking. So the importance of teaching how to do that skill appropriately, and I think the same sort of concept applies in soccer in terms of, you know, developmentally teaching kids appropriately how to do the skill. And it is tougher to know when can you safely introduce certain aspects of a game into the sport. At the same time, understanding, as Kevin said, there is risk of injury in any sport, and so you have to be willing to accept some amount of injury. But I think that I'm an injury prevention researcher at heart, and I really think there's always stuff that we can be doing to make the game safer. Youth sports are safe. We can always make them safer, and we will strive to do so. But I am a firm believer in kids continuing to be active in sports, and I think sometimes we lose sight of all those positive messages because of some of the negativity and the fear about injury.
We're talking to Dr. Allison Brooks from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and Dr. Kevin Walter from the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. And we're talking about kids, sports, and concussions. Everybody's watching the numbers, the research coming out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a parent, a young athlete, or a coach, how do you deal with a suspected concussion, a head injury? Have things changed in recent years? Are there sports you would not let your kid play because of the risk of concussion? Or do you weigh the risk? And as both of our experts do say, no, the benefits of youth sports outweigh it. Let's just be safe. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be back with a conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about kids and concussions and sports. We've got two Wisconsin experts with us, Dr. Kevin Walter from the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, Dr. Allison Brooks from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. New study finds a big increase, more than double over an 8-year span when it comes to concussions in that 10 to 19 age range, but that's maybe because we're paying more attention, not because there are more injuries. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you see more awareness of concussions in school and club sports? If you're a coach, a parent, or an athlete, are possible concussions being taken more seriously? How do things work on your sidelines? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Ben on the line in Wisconsin. Ben, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I think that whatever a kid is passionate for, you should let them do it, especially if it's a sports activity. There's a huge epidemic also in our society of, I think, people lacking activity. I mean, you know, staying home more and doing stuff, you know, in terms of from an internet-based area, and getting them to get out and do stuff with other people is a great experience.
Ben, thanks.
Go
ahead.
I was both a player and a coach, and I love, you know, not looking back at those times, but running into those people more or less that you did stuff with. It's always fun to see them, and it's a different experience rather than seeing someone else you didn't do anything with.
Ben, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts and your experiences. Dr. Walter, I mean, we hear almost a tone of panic sometimes from us in the media, I'll admit, about concussions in sports. But do you think most people out there are in Ben's category and yours that, yes, it's a worry, but the benefits outweigh the risks?
I think so. I do. I think so. And it's hard. So at Children's, we see a lot of high school and younger kids that come in injured, and families and parents are really concerned. When it happens to your kid and your kid is headachy and struggling to pay attention and having difficulty in school, and then they turn on ESPN and they hear these terrible stories of professional athletes with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and it automatically they just leap to that fear of, oh my gosh, is this going to be my child? And you know, no, not if you treat it appropriately. It's not going to get to that point. So I think there's a lot more fear than there used to be back 10 years ago. But I still think overall, when I have conversations with families, and they can take a deep breath and recognize that my kid is not going to be devastated if we take care of their concussion effectively, they take a deep breath, and then they start to drift back and recognize how beneficial sport can be.
Ben, thanks for that call. We just lost Abby in Sturgeon Bay, but she wanted to know, on a practical level, what kind of symptoms to watch for a potential concussion. Dr. Brooks, can you start us off on that?
Well, sure. I mean, what's challenging about this injury is, you know, there's a cluster of symptoms, and every individual is different in terms of, you know, how they specifically might present with a concussion. But we tend to think of them in sort of different domains, either, you know, physical symptoms or cognitive symptoms or neuropsychological symptoms, but certainly headache, feeling foggy, feeling like things are in slow motion, are common ones, being overly sensitive to light and noise, and, you know, certainly the athlete who at a, you know, athletic competition clearly seems confused and they can't remember the play, or you keep asking questions to teammates, or, you know, another area I think that's important is from a personality standpoint, how is that athlete acting, and that's where having athletic trainers on the sideline is so important. People who really know the athletes well and can tell when they're acting strange, not themselves, either being, you know, more emotional or irritable. You know, some of those really subtle changes in this is not how this person usually acts. Sometimes being nauseated, I would say vomiting is a rare symptom, and when athletes are vomiting, we tend to obviously do more evaluation to make sure there's not a more significant injury. But there's a whole list, and they're not all specific to concussion, right? There are other things that can cause those same symptoms, which is part of what makes this still in many ways a challenging diagnosis.
And that's a good time to pull kids out of a game, obviously. Dr. Walter, briefly, we're just about out of time. When do we definitely seek immediate medical attention for a suspected concussion?
Immediate medical attention. If there's loss of consciousness, you've got to assume that that athlete not only has a concussion, but also a neck injury potentially. Repetitive vomiting, like Dr. Brooks had said, obviously seizures. But the big ones are three things, in my opinion. One, if any of their symptoms are getting worse, worsening headache, worsening dizziness, worsening nausea, you've got to go in and get it taken care of. Number two, if it's the worst headache they've ever had, tears in their eyes, crying for the headache, you've got to go in. And then number three, if you're just uncomfortable, if you as a parent or as a coach on the sideline is nervous about that young athlete in front of you, you've got to get them to a place like an ER or an urgent care where they can get looked at and be reassured, because what you look for is something more than concussion, like a brain bleed or a skull fracture, things like that.
We'll leave it with that advice. Thanks to Dr. Kevin Walter from the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, Dr. Allison Brooks from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Across the country, communities are grappling with the relationship between police and people of color. People are angry. People are hurting. This summer in Madison, there's been debate about whether the police department needs to change. As Bridget Bowden reports, city residents agree that the community needs to move forward, even if all the answers aren't clear.
At the beginning of last month, Madison Police Chief Mike Koval wrote a blog post. It was about an upcoming city council vote to add $350,000 from the city's reserves to a study of police policies and procedures. He said he didn't have a problem with the department being reviewed, but didn't think it was a wise use of that much money. Some alders took issue with the blog's language, saying it was violent and divisive. It said, "To the common council, you are being watched, and be on notice. This is a preemptive strike from me to you." The next day at a city council meeting, these tensions came to a boil. Alder Samba Balde said this about Chief Koval, who was sitting behind him.
"The behavior of the chief tonight, honestly, is unimaginable. I was totally afraid for him to be behind me with a gun."
Plenty of people used sharp words that night. Council members, the chief, community members. Here's an exchange between Chief Koval and Alder Balde.
Can I just clarify that as a police officer of 33 years with a stellar record, I really resent the inference that you thought that someone sitting behind you with a gun was going to be a clear and present danger to you?
That is because of your behavior.
The council approved the extra money. Now a committee is looking for the right candidate to actually do the review. But for Brandy Grayson, one of the founders of Young, Gifted, and Black, that's not enough. She stood on the steps of City Hall and asked for community control of the police.
"And we are not making progress until we acknowledge the wounds, because we cannot heal the wounds until we acknowledge the wounds. So let's stop playing, Madison."
She said that people of color are brutalized by the police, specifically mentioning Janelle Laird, a black teenager who was arrested at Easttown Mall. A viral video of the encounter shows a struggle and her being tased by officers.
"So don't you drop the race card. Don't you pretend like this is about anything else but racism."
On the other side of the issue, there are people like David Glomp, who lives in West Madison. He says the debate needs to move beyond race.
"I welcome every ethnicity in this city to come together and say, enough with this. And we need to come together and figure out a way that we can work through this."
Glomp says he supports police officers, so much so that he put a sign in his yard.
"And it's a bright yellow sign with white lettering.
It says, we support our Madison Police Department, and he's distributed hundreds just like it." But then, right in the middle of this debate, there was a week that shook the nation. The killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile by police and the killing of five police officers in Dallas again ignited racial tensions. For many, it was incredibly disheartening. Veronica Lasso is a member of the Police Review Committee. She says it's time for tangible changes in the way policing is done.
"People are tired of coming together to talk about little pieces here and there. People are tired, too, of marching every time some catastrophe happens. How many marches is it going to take for us to really get to the bottom of these?"
Last week, Madison Mayor Paul Soglin and a coalition of grassroots organizers proposed a $3 million plan to address racial disparities and violence. Tim Maiman was involved with that group. Even with the plan, he says, he doesn't have all the answers.
"This is a devastating effect that is happening in this community and around the world. Do we have the answers to how the police should treat a human being? Probably not. But do we need everybody to sit down and come up with these answers? Yes."
Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.